I think that even was like this kind of like watershed moment for lots of people, like, whoa, this is a business. Oh, right, Facebook is a business. I'm using the site for free. How do they make money? What's going on here? Oh, they're selling my data. They're selling my attention. They're selling my content. Why don't I get a share?
My guest this week is Dr. Susanne Kopf, a discourse analyst in Vienna, Austria. I recently came across her academic paper on the corporations that own social media companies and the power relations between them and content creators.
I went into this with an open mind because as a researcher, that's what I have to do. And I was like, okay, so they call this the YouTube Partner Program. And yeah, what I found, spoiler alert, partner is not really an apt term for what like content creators standing here.
The president met with congressional leaders. Doctors will start implanting the devices.
And he heard that warning from the Coast Guard tonight.
Now we're live in Orlando.
Now we're live in Dallas. We're live in Boston tonight. Caitlin McCulley, 7 News 19.
I'm Caitlin McCulley. I left my job as a TV news reporter in a pandemic to try to find a better way to share stories that matter, no BS. Thanks for listening to Outlet Podcast. You can download new episodes each week.
Here's Dr. Susanne Kopf.
Well, I appreciate you taking time. I just happened to come across your article because this is an area that I'm really interested in. Your article talking about the power relations between these big social media companies and the people creating the content for free or for a little to no money. And I just hadn't heard it framed in these terms before as digital labor, which it is. The article that I read was related to YouTube in particular, but I think it has broader implications to other social media companies that are allowing creators to upload content. And somehow they've kind of tricked us all into thinking that our content is free and that our time is not worth anything and that they're the ones that should make the millions and billions of dollars off of this content.
Yeah, absolutely. They kind of tricked us, didn't they? I got interested in social media because I use social media, right, every day. And I get interested in like, okay, who actually, like I can use this all for free. So who actually benefits from me doing this? And that's how I got interested. Oh, there are corporations behind social media. These corporations provide social media and they make money off of it. How? And obviously, like we've had this conversation as a global society, I guess, like, okay, there are these, they use the data that users provide and they advertise stuff to us. So they sell our audience attention, if you will, we as the audience.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's also these creative people, these content creators who spend a lot of time and sometimes a lot of money, I guess, on equipment, especially. And lots of other stuff, lots of time and effort and money making this content that these corporations then build their profits on, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I'm a discourse analyst. I'm interested in how people use language and I try to understand society through the linguistic lens, so to speak. So I analyze language and discourse, the way people use language to understand, okay, where are they coming from? What could they possibly be thinking? How do they make sense of the world? How do they see certain people, certain groups? How do institutions conceptualize certain people? And so I thought, I could look at how social media, corporations actually communicate. Mm-hmm. So I could focus on how these businesses actually talk to us. And so I started to look beyond the veil, so to speak. I started to go backstage, the front stage, you could say, okay, everybody using social media, but then I wanted to see, okay, how do they actually talk about stuff, talk to us as users, talk to content creators. So that is how I got interested in that. And then also, obviously, I'm a discourse analyst. I opened my books, I started reading journal articles and like, what kind of research is out there already? And there is this research on digital labor and how people get exploited, possibly, one can view it as exploitation. People using social media and these corporations benefiting from that and people not getting paid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's this whole world of theory out there, if you will. And I was like, okay, but how? And they talk mostly about free digital labor, about the content that we all create on an everyday basis, using social media, and these corporations benefiting. But I was like, okay, but what about paid digital labor? What about these content creators that actually get the opportunity to monetize and to get at least some remuneration for their digital labor? Mm-hmm. And the first thing that came to mind was the YouTube Partner Program, because it's one of the oldest monetization schemes. It's, I think it was founded in 2007. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they set up this program where they actually invited creators to also share in profits. Say, okay, you can monetize your content. We will run advertising on your content. We'll also make money on your content, but you can share in this because we recognize, we acknowledge that this is a lot of work and we want your content because
we need it.
And that's the key thing. Social media depend on content creators and on users. There is the network effect. In order to have a valuable social media platform, you need people, you need users. What is a social media platform without its users and without content? So users and content and people attract more people, which again increases the value of the site. So yes, social media corporations absolutely depend on the users and content creators. And so it kind of made sense for me to look at, okay, YouTube giving content creators the opportunity to share in these profits, because this is just acknowledging and paying people, paying the people that kind of work for you or that provide this kind of digital product. And of course, like, YouTube has changed a lot, and there was the the advertising boycott in 2017, that has like a name, some clever blend of a name, Apocalypse or something.
Okay.
Like, Apocalypse, but Adpocalypse or something.
Okay.
But it was an advertising boycott because, you know, when you have content on YouTube and then some brand runs an ad on it, mm-hmm. It could be problematic if the content doesn't really match the brand identity. So YouTube ran into some problems there. There was problematic content on YouTube and YouTube ran ads. And the advertisers were shocked.
That's right. I do remember that. Yeah.
Right. And they were shocked. And they were like, we cannot be associated with this kind of content. This is harming our brand identity. What are you doing, YouTube? Mm-hmm. So we're going to boycott you. So YouTube had to change its policies. And that mostly affected the advertiser-friendly content guidelines, to use YouTube's lingo there. But yeah, the YouTube Partner Program has undergone some changes. But I thought, why not take a look at what it is like now? In 2020, that was when I started writing this paper, when I worked on this. So I collected all the information that I could find where YouTube addresses its monetizing content creators. And I want to find out, how does YouTube actually conceptualize and conceive of the power relations between it as a company and the people providing the content and the people also making money off of that? So the monetizing content creators.
And there are different levels to that, like the people who are providing content for free, and then this other level of the partners, quote unquote partners, which I want to ask you if that is the right word that as you see it, but
I went into this with an open mind because as a researcher, that's what I have to do. And I was like, okay, so they call this the YouTube Partner Program. And yeah, what I found, spoiler alert, partner is not really an apt term for what like content creators standing here. They are not, I mean, partner implies a relationship of equals, right? Yeah, that is not really how YouTube portrays its monetizing content creators, not at all. If you look at the linguistic data, YouTube does represent itself as the rule maker, the rule enforcer, And also, if you want to appeal certain decisions, the judge, the executive force, the judge that gets to evaluate whether your appeal should be granted or not, and then the executive force again in carrying out the decision. Mm-hmm. So the power lies all with YouTube. It represents itself this way, and it lets its monetizing content creators or people who are interested in becoming a content creator who gets to monetize know that there's this power imbalance in no uncertain terms. It's all about you have to follow certain rules. We will monitor you. If you do not comply, we will take certain actions.
Do you think that YouTube also plays upon the dynamic between if you are selected or chosen to be a partner, that it makes you feel special or somehow better than the people who are providing this content for free?
Absolutely. That is actually another key finding of my research. YouTube rewards certain content creators by allowing them into the inner circle, so to speak, the echelons, the higher level, so to speak. It also says something like, repeatedly, there are these statements, you made it into the YPP, the YouTube Partner Program. Congratulations. We want to make sure that we only reward the good creators. So we get this message of we're rewarding you. This is like a bonus. This is a goodie because you've been good. You've been providing us with good content and you have the watch hours and you're doing all the stuff that we need you to do in order for us to reward you.
This is major psychology here.
Yeah, it works. It sounds like a privilege to be part of the YPP. It's a real privilege to get paid for your work. There. if you're very cynical, you can say like, oh, I'm putting in all this work and I'm getting paid for it. That's so nice.
And so you looked at YouTube in particular with this. But this is a trend. I mean, with all these other social media companies, the big ones, the original ones, Facebook, I know recently Mark Zuckerberg has been talking about wanting to give creators the opportunity to monetize their content. A lot of people are concerned about this because they feel, you know, maybe this is a land grab in this big creator economy and maybe they don't have the best interest of the creators at heart here. What do you think?
I'd say it depends. It depends on how it's done. I mean, allowing people to share in profits and getting paid for the work that they do, that sounds like a very good idea at first glance. Like, we allow you this great opportunity, but it really depends on what you have to sacrifice in order to make this kind of money. I mean, in another piece that I'm working on right now, I look at at corporate censorship on social media, actually, and I look at the content guidelines that you have to meet in order to be eligible for advertising revenue on YouTube, in this case again. And I mean, the guidelines themselves, I mean, you could say some of the stuff, okay, of course, you have to weigh like freedom of speech versus protecting people's personality rights, protecting against hate speech. So there, an incitement and
right. So content moderation is a big.
It's a big box. It's a big thing. Obviously, there's something to be said for like protecting people and content moderation for the good of society. But then there's also the ad-friendly content guidelines. If you want to make money on a social media site and you provide content that is a bit more outside the box, that I'm not talking like intense stuff, then you might get demonetized. So there is this danger of a loss of content plurality. If you have strict guidelines on what can be monetized through advertising, or as I have found in my recent study, the guidelines are kind of wishy-washy. So if you want to be on the safe side and you want to get paid for your efforts, you want to play it safe and you want to make sure that you get monetized. You want to make sure that you stay within the narrowest and the tamest definition of what is advertisable content, right? Hmm. So we might end up with kind of like tabloidized social media sphere. So I don't know, critical engagement, a critical debate could be to a degree sacrificed on the altar of capitalism and making money through advertising.
When you say tabloidizing social media, yeah. I think I know what you mean, but if you could describe that some more.
Well, if you want your content to be advertiser friendly, it has to be rather innocent. It shouldn't be controversial. It shouldn't deal with sensitive issues or anything that could upset certain people or that could upset the brand that might want to run ads, right? Mm-hmm. So if you touch on anything that is potentially a bit more challenging or a bit more critical, then ads might, or like the brands behind ads might shy away from wanting to run ads on your content. So to be safe, you might want to stick with kitten, puppies, and cosmetics. That's what I pretty much, I mean, that's the bottom line, and that's the very end of the spectrum, right? I mean, that's, again, me being kind of like, yeah, trying to, yeah, it's probably sounding a bit cynical, but that's the end of it, right? If you like follow that, it's a, yeah.
Well, and we've all also seen, and this is anecdotal, obviously, I haven't done extensive research on this, but I mean, you see just by participating in these in social media sites like Instagram and Facebook and TikTok, what usually does well, what's very easy for people to like and share is stuff that's really benign and maybe not all that valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't have anything against, you know, I have two cats. I love cats and I'm totally into cat videos. I'm fine with that. And it's, I can easily give this my like, and I'm like, okay, this is going to make my day, and life is tough enough as it is at the moment.
Right.
Actually. If you want to think about all the global challenges that we're facing and us needing these transnational spheres of engagement, I mean, climate change is not going to be a national issue.
Right.
The coronavirus pandemic is not an issue that can be resolved nationally. It's a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So having these spaces where we can engage with these difficult and challenging issues is important. And I'm not saying that that's not possible on social media, but it's, at least for monetizing creators, it's discouraged. And if more and more people want to monetize, then what is going to happen to our social media platforms? Where can we have these transnational debates? Where can I discuss with a bunch of strangers? I mean, we also have the issue of filter bubbles and echo chambers and that.
Yes.
But there's also that problem, the algorithms and a whole box of other stuff that I don't even want to get into. But if we already have the issue that certain content is not
palatable.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Then that is a problem. And again, I want to emphasize that there's certain content that content moderation is important, and weighing freedom of expression versus protecting people. I mean, you can't say everything because language can be dangerous and you can incite violence, as we've seen before, not too recent past. So I'm not speaking up against content moderation in its entirety, just economically motivated censorship. Mm-hmm. That comes with this trend towards monetization. That is just something that I would view critically.
Mm-hmm. I think creators and of all kinds, people making various kinds of content are kind of waking up to this idea that, hey, you know, I spent a lot of time on this. I spent a lot of money. I invested a lot of money for this equipment. I'm not really seeing a lot of return on that. I know some people personally who have participated in the YouTube partnership program and are trying to monetize their content. Have you done research related or are aware of the percentage of people who can actually make a living wage monetizing their content on YouTube?
I have not looked into that. Not yet. That will be, because there are also different ways of monetizing, right? I mean, you can monetize through ads. You can build up your own store. And that is something where it gets kind of like the lines get blurred, right? You can have your YouTube channel or your Insta channel and then advertise products that you, that you yourself sell. Mm-hmm. So the YouTube partnership program allows you to also link people to products that you then want to sell to people.
Right. So linking a physical sale is something to this video.
Yeah. So you can like, it allows you to have your own business presence there as well.
True.
And I know a few channels and a few people from channels who started out saying, okay, I'm going to do YouTube for fun. Oh, I'm going to do this for money, for the advertising income. And then like, you know what? I'm just going to also produce my own products because I'm good at painting. I'm good at, I have all these cool, cute sayings and I can print this on t-shirts and sell that mm-hmm. and advertise this through YouTube and have people redirected to my webpage so they can sell stuff there. Mm-hmm. Or the people can buy stuff there, but I can sell stuff. So there's a whole mechanism there as well. But yeah, personally, I have not done research on that and I have not followed these people in any systematic way of like, catching up with them.
What do you think would happen if everyone on YouTube who's making videos decided, I'm not going to do that anymore?
Collective action to end content creation. I think YouTube would collapse pretty quickly. I mean, there's still like this whole old stuff that is on there. But if everybody decided we're not going to add any new stuff, I think YouTube would run into trouble really quickly. And that is where, yeah, that could also be a potential solution. I don't know how realistic that is. I'm quite sure it's not very realistic.
Of course.
But if all content creators banded together and took collective action, unionization, mm-hmm. Then they could bring YouTube and social media in general to a standstill. If only the group of current monetizing creators banded together, I don't think that would be enough because YouTube would just say, okay, so you're being stubborn, so you're boycotting us. Well, we're just going to move on to the next group of people who are still willing to produce and upload content for free. Mm-hmm. So I think they would just move on. So it would
move down their tier.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of people who are not part of the YPP who also produce marketable content and who produce content that people watch. And mm-hmm. the network effect still works.
Right, right. Yeah. But so YouTube was pretty early on, 2007. I wasn't aware this program was around. I mean, mm-hmm. when did YouTube start? Around that time or before?
I think it wasn't YouTube started like 2004, 2005 already?
Yeah. Okay. So it had been around a few years and then introduced this program. You would think on the one hand that encouraging people or making people aware that they can monetize it or maybe they should monetize it could have an impact on their whole business of people uploading it for free, like just suggesting that idea, but it hasn't done that.
Has it not? I don't know. It's just that.
I mean, maybe.
Maybe we just don't notice because there are still so many people who are on YouTube. Maybe it's just, even if it's just 10% of all content creators think like, maybe I'm going to approach this differently, or 10% of everybody with an internet connection being aware and thinking,
Yeah.
Would we really notice? I mean, there's so many people online. Would we notice? I'm not sure. And another thing that I think is not unimportant, I mean, that's another piece of research that I'm working on. People have apparently become more aware that social media are businesses. I think for the longest time, there was this lack of awareness that social media are operated or social media platforms are operated
yes.
by these corporations. And people are getting more and more aware. I mean, the Cambridge Analytica scandal, I think, helped a lot with that. Or even the IPO when Facebook went public in 2012, yep. right? I think that even was like this kind of like watershed moment for lots of people like, whoa, this is a business. Oh, right. Facebook is a business. I'm using the site for free. How do they make money? What's going on here? Oh, they're selling my data. They're selling my attention. They're selling my content. Why don't I get a share? And I think that is kind of the process that we're going through at the moment.
Do you think we're entering a new phase of social media?
In terms of monetization or?
Yeah, in terms of monetization, in terms of growing awareness that they're a business, in terms of selling attention, selling data.
Yes.
I feel like there's something happening here.
Yes, absolutely. I'm quite certain that there's this increase in awareness. I'm certain that this was not here, like 10 years ago even, people were not as aware that there are these business models. behind social media. They're not doing this just to connect people, but there's some money in this. And I think, I'm quite sure that there is this increase in awareness. There's this one piece, it's not representative of all people, obviously, and it's not representative of all social media, but there's this piece of research that I'm working on right now where you can clearly trace this increase of awareness, at least in the Wikipedia community. Because on Wikipedia, there's lots of people discussing social media because there are also discussion spaces on Wikipedia. So I looked at those discussions. How do people actually talk about certain social media sites?
Okay.
And I found that because Wikipedia was created in 2001, then we got Facebook in 2004, and so on and so forth. So they started creating these articles for different social media sites. And in the discussions that they have about these different sites, you can see the increase in awareness. Oh yeah, these are businesses. And yeah, absolutely. So if we take this piece of research that I have here as a starting point, and if that holds true, then absolutely. And the conversations that we have, even just beyond my piece of research there, I mean, people are quite aware that when they have a Facebook account, an Instagram account, a TikTok account, that they're giving away certain rights, that their data might be used in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So I feel that people have or are developing this awareness. And there is this saying that has been around for ages. If you're not paying for the product, you are the product.
Yes.
One of those sayings. And it gets banded around again in the context of social media. And that shows that we as a global society, we are starting to have these conversations. So yes, I'm sure. That was a long answer.
No, it's great. It's great. The fact that that attention is the product, your attention, you essentially are being bought and sold for these companies. I mean, that's kind of my thinking in regards to the TV news industry, which is where I came from, and how I'm convinced we have to change the model in order to make the people viewing the content the customer and not the product. So it's a small problem to solve, but I'm really excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah, really small. That's going to happen overnight. But I checked out some of the episodes, and obviously I haven't got around to listening to all of them yet, but I'm like, yes, yes. I've actually started talking to my colleagues about this, that there's actually a podcast out there. You would be interested in this.
Oh, good. Thank you.
So this is fascinating stuff. And I think you're really brave because obviously you started this during the pandemic. So I'm like,
thank you. Yeah. You know, it was one of those things I knew I had to leave. I just had such clarity that I care about this industry, and I care about people being informed and having access to information and having, you know, being able to communicate in a way that is not driven by sensationalism and attention. And you know, I just see what it's done, both cable news networks, TV news model, business model, and also the social media factor and the algorithms and everything. And it's just, it's a mess. I knew I wanted to try to find a better way to do this. And this podcast really, and talking to so many people in the industry and experts, has kind of led me down this path.
I mean, podcasts could be part of the answer, couldn't they? Because yes, you can monetize through creating podcasts, and yes, you can reach people and you can have critical debates. I mean, this is an actual discussion.
Right.
Whereas on Twitter, we just scream into the void most of the time, and the person who has most of the followers or who gets most likes within the hour gets pushed to the forefront because
yes,
algorithms. And with podcasts, I feel you can go deeper. I mean, it's more, it's a really good way of getting out of the business, I guess, but still being part of changing it. Changing the conversation about it, or raising awareness that we have this cycle of this weird way of doing media these days.
Yes.